Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Well, welcome to our first video in a series of many on inflation. We are putting these videos out because we're getting a ton of questions from people, and people want to know what's going on, why it's happening, what they can do to be prepared. So we wanted to put these together to really help everyone both understand what's going on and also prepare for the next stage of what's going to be happening. So this week we have our very own Doug Hegren to interview me again and to really kind of talk through some of this. A lot of people wanted Doug back, so we're bringing him back.
Thanks for you wanting to have me back, because that's really what matters. But last week, you know, I remember we were talking quite a bit about this paradigm shift that you foresee that's coming here. But obviously, one of the questions that we're getting a lot of is this thing that's going on with inflation. And a lot of people want to know, is this short term, long term? There's some new numbers that came out today from the government. Let's talk more about that today, because I think that the questions that people are going to have, the first place that they're going to see it is in their own pocketbook. The wallets are feeling a little bit lighter right now every time you drive to drop your kids off at school or to or from work. So what do you feel about this? Where did this problem come from with inflation?
Let's start with what the problem is, because I think it's not clear if you read anything associated with finance or the economy. Most people have the wrong information. I mean, there's definitely people out there saying what the truth is, but there are a lot of media people that are just parroting old or wrong information because it sounds good and it's a good soundbite. We all know there's a lot of, you know, quote unquote, fake news out there, depending on who you like and don't like. But I think mostly it's just due to a lack of understanding. So it's not deliberate. Now, here's where the problem starts. 40 years ago, in pretty much 1981, we hit interest rates of, depending on which rate you were, anywhere between 15 and 20%. That was really the peak. Now, prior to that, I think it was around the mid late 60s, we were in a similar place than we are today, which is high inflation, low interest rates. And interest rates started climbing until finally they got to the 15 to 20% range, depending on which interest rate you're talking about. So at that point in time, that was the peak interest rates. And subsequently, for the next 40 years, interest rates dropped. First, they dropped quickly and then they dropped more slowly, but they kept dropping for 40 years. What that allowed is, think of it this way. I'll use real estate as an example. Let's say you want to buy a house, $100,000 house. You can pay cash, assuming you have $100,000, you can pay cash for the house, or you can put down $20,000 and you could take out a mortgage for that $80,000. Now, if interest rates are at 20%, that's going to be really tough, because 20% a year in interest rates, let's say instead of $80,000, it's $100,000. So you're paying 20 grand a year in interest. That's tough.
Hard to put any money towards the principal when you're keeping the lights on at the bank.
Here's the issue. When interest rates are high, it's really hard to leverage. It's really hard to borrow money because it's expensive. So what that does is that means that people have less money to spend on assets, and it causes asset prices to be lower because you just can't expand. You can't buy more. However, as interest rates go from 20% down to, a few months ago, they were 2%, if you can believe it, 30-year mortgage for 2%. Went down to 2%, I can buy a lot more house on 2% because the payments are lower. Now, in the 80s, the 70s and 80s, people weren't buying on payments. They had money saved, they were responsible. But when you could start borrowing money with ease, people started living off of payments. Think of your credit card. Oh, I can buy those really nice shoes today and I can pay for them over the next few months.
My daughter wants a saxophone and it's a couple grand, but oh, I can do $40 a month. It makes it feel a lot easier.
Right. But you have to pay for that at some point. So all it means is you're taking future earnings that you're going to use to pay for this and you're bringing it in today. So you're buying it today and you're paying it over the next 2 years or whatever it is. So that means in the next 2 years, you're going to be poor because you have less money to pay for other things because you're paying for that saxophone now. Now, if you think about it, once you go from 20% down to 2%, you have a lot more flexibility with your payments. I'm going to take a guess at this, and we probably hit the real estate peak when we were at that 2% 30-year mortgage. I'll use a quick example here just before we move on. If you have a $700,000 house at 2%, it's about $2,500 a month. If that interest rate on your mortgage goes up to 7.5%, it's now $5,000 a month. So you've effectively doubled your payment you have to pay for that mortgage, which means you can afford half the same house, which means the house is $350,000. I'm not suggesting real estate's going to crash 50%, But directionally, that's where it's going because that's what you can afford. And people pay for what they can afford. A lot of people are overstretched. They don't have extra money saved because they're paying on payments. So unless you have money saved, this is going to be really tough for a lot of people. I'm trying to explain the concept on real estate because real estate is one of those assets everybody understands. Now, think about real estate, but instead of real estate, think about it as the economy. The economy expanded, a ton of wealth was created, abundance was created in our economy. We made lots of progress in technology and business, and everyone was doing well. Everyone's making plenty of money. And a lot of that was because we had cheap and easy money. But now, that paradigm that we've had for the last 40 years is reversing. So everything you think you know about finance and investing and the markets is most likely going to be the opposite of what it used to be because that paradigm of lowering rates is now raising rates. So it means everything that happened is now going to be the inverse.
Again, if you've got $2,500 for the same mortgage that becomes $5,000 for the same mortgage, it eliminates a lot of people who could potentially buy. What would you say to the individuals out there? And I find this a lot of people that are in the mortgage or real estate industry that will repeat that, hey, it's not going to matter. The real estate industry is fine. It's supply versus demand and people need homes.
Yeah, and that's actually a great argument. And I can't disagree with it. Here's where I say it is going to be different. So I don't think the dynamics are going to change from what I said. I think that interest rates, as they go up, it's going to cause real estate prices to drop. It's based on affordability. Residential homes are based on affordability and people can afford less, which means the price are going to go down. We're already seeing that. It hasn't only been a few months in real estate. New homes values have dropped significantly. We just had some data come out today. I haven't seen it yet, so I can't regurgitate it for you. But I know that home prices are starting to drop.
I saw something. Colorado homes are starting to sit a little bit longer before those transactions go through, a lot less competitive offers. So there is some data coming out.
And remember that in 2005, the real estate market peaked and we didn't have a crash until 2008. So real estate markets operate slower. But getting back to your point, so the dynamic of interest rates is really important because people buy homes on interest rates. Now, you also made the point of there aren't enough homes to go around. People have to live somewhere, which is true. And this is one of the things driving new homes is we can't build enough homes to supply all the people that need them. However, you can rent. There are apartments, there are condos, there are buildings that you can live in that are still homes. They're just compressed. So apartments is an example. There are plenty of rentals that people can buy. You just have to go find a rental and they will build more. Rental properties should do reasonably well considering what real estate is doing. But if you're looking at trends, it's kind of hard to argue against affordability because that's the way real estate prices move. There is speculation. There's a lot of, you know, when you have cheap and easy money like before 2008 or recently, it was really easy to get loans for good rates, but now things are changing and I think people are going to start to see that. I do want to put one caveat in here because I think we started renting 2 years ago because heck, that's a better option. Like why buy a really expensive home when I can just rent and wait it out? Now, one of the caveats is if you have a home and you're not going to sell it for the next 10 years, none of this really matters to you because what really matters is, are you buying or selling a home in the next 5 years? Let's just say. I don't know how long this is going to last. I can guess, but let's say in the next 5 years or so, if you're going to buy or sell a home, then doing it now is probably going to be a better option for you. If you own a home that you're going to own for the next 50 years, none of this matters because a home is a personal expense. It is not an investment, and that's a whole nother category. But basically, think of it this way. If you have a 2% 30-year mortgage, what do you care what the price is? If I lived in a perfect world, interest rates are 20%, I would buy one of those with the 20% mortgage and wait till rates came down and I would refinance all the way down and my payments get cheaper and I bought it cheap and now it's worth more money. That's the ideal scenario. But realistically, if you're not going to sell it, then it really doesn't matter.
Well, let's go back to the renting thing. You mentioned people view their house as an investment, but in reality, whether you're renting or whether you're buying, it's no different. You're talking about a contract with an entity, whether it is the landlord or the bank, to have a place to sleep. That's what it's about. Now, a house is going to have a lot more expenses, 70% in some arguments, I think Zillow and a couple of the other home blog companies have said over the last 2 years that 70% of the people that bought during that period actually regret it because A, how expensive the home was to buy, and B, they did not estimate the level of added expense that came from actually having to be a homeowner, all of the maintenance, upgrades, furnishings, et cetera. That's a very big reality of the cost that's there. Now, you also mentioned with apartments, yes, people can rent. We have a supply issue of both rentals and a supply issue of homes, which is a problem on both ends, which is why rents have been skyrocketing. It's not going to be easy to meet that demand on the supply side with rising interest rates either, because all of a sudden it becomes more expensive to build the new homes and to build the new apartments. I think I saw this today or yesterday, but a lot of the newer landlords that have built or purchased apartments in the last couple of years, the last year or two, are starting to get squeezed as well because they are having much more expense from the purchase of that more expensive apartment and the interest rates to manage the debt on that versus what they can actually charge for rent. So that's going to be an interesting dichotomy that's going to be coming forward. One last thing I wanted to talk about, and maybe you could address, and I've got some thoughts on it too, is you talked about if we bought it at 20%, rates are going down, refinance. What about those that did? So this argument, should I pay off my house quickly or not? That being, you know, having your house paid off allows you to be debt free. And there's people that are sitting in 2.5%, they're still accelerating their debt payments. What do you think of that?
So if you bought an apartment complex, some people buy like 100 unit buildings or what have you. One of the challenges when interest rates are so low, a lot of people levered up as much as they could, because the rate of return you were getting was ridiculous. I mean, people were buying, not to confuse people, but people talk about cap ratios or cap rates. You know, somebody was buying, I would maybe look for a 10 to 12 cap rate for me if I'm looking. People in the city were paying a cap rate of 2 to 3, which means effectively you're getting about 2 to 3%. Plus there's other expenses that come out of that. So you're really cutting it close, right? It's really tight.
In a nutshell, the lower the cap rate, you're basically not getting enough rents against the expenses that you have.
Right. Your return is lower, effectively. The point I'm making is a lot of people are stretching themselves to get into homes just so they can get the cash flow. And that's assuming that they're going to have low rates for a long period of time. The problem is the paradigm is changing, and now we're going to be into higher rates. Now, in of itself, if you have a 2% 10-year mortgage, that might be fine. But the problem with a lot of commercial buildings, apartment buildings would be an example, those roll over every 5 or 10 years, which means that you have to refinance every 5 to 10 years, depending on where you are in your cycle. So if rates are a lot higher, you're in hot water, and which means that you have to sell that property because you won't be able to refinance it and make the payments work. Now, one of the challenges is that refinanceability, which is actually a problem with companies as well. We haven't gotten to that yet, but companies have that same problem. So realistically, one way to handle it is to pay down the debt. And anybody who's been around for a while, who's been through a few real estate cycles, knows that during times like this, you pay down the debt. Because yes, it's great to have those low rates, but when you refinance, the payments aren't going to work anymore. So you might as well just pay it down. So a lot of people are doing that. They're paying down debt. They're reducing leverage. And this gets back to the point I said earlier, right? Back in the 70s, leverage was low because rates were high. So you couldn't leverage as much. So that amount that you could leverage was a lot less. So think of it like a balloon. If there isn't such thing as debt, the balloon looks like this. As soon as you start adding debt, it allows it to expand and expand until 2% 30-year mortgages is way out here. And then at some point, it's going to start to contract. So if you think of it that way, like everything contracts together with debt because we've stretched ourselves to the limit. So that means that people aren't saving. They're saving, they're investing, but they're not making anything. If you have 20% interest rates, you're saving a ton. You're not borrowing, so you might as well save it. So everything that you think you know about the economy and the markets is going to change because it has to. Because the dynamics, they can't sustain themselves at higher rates. We've been accustomed to low rates for 20 years. We've gotten spoiled. We've gotten fragile, as I like to say. Any sort of speed bump that comes your way, you're going to fall apart. You know, you need to become more resilient. One of the ways to become more resilient is to pay down that debt. So the first key is to pay down variable debt first. That is the hardest thing, because if rates go from 2% up to 10%, you're going to feel it. I mean, credit cards did this 3 years ago. I mean, I have great credit and they bumped my rates up to 15%. And I said, hey, what are you doing? They're like, hey, we got to make money too. Like, these are the lowest rates I have. I'm like, really? Like, yeah, this is literally no one has any lower rates than this. Now, granted, I had another card with 4%, but that's a whole other story. The point being is get rid of variable debt first, because that's going to hurt. Fixed debt you can do later, but you want to delever as much as possible.
Now, when you say delever as much as possible, and I know you're talking about some of these debts are going to have to come up and be forced to refinance. But if you're in a 30-year mortgage and you're at 2.5% and interest rates are going up or inflation's going up on everything else, would it not make sense to not necessarily accelerate that debt? If you had a $2,500 mortgage today, inflation is 3%, you know, as it's historically been, you go out 20 years from now, that payment, that $2,500 payment is only going to feel like $1,384 a month compared to everything else around you going up in cost. Now that we're in a higher interest rate environment, let's just say 7%, 20 years from now, that $2,500 payment in comparison to everything else is only going to feel like $646. So essentially, if you are locked into a low rate for a long time and you're trying to decide where to put your money, if you are putting an accelerating paying off a 2.5% mortgage that's locked for 30 years, aren't you effectively putting your most valuable dollars today and giving those away on that mortgage when there are many other things that you're going to feel the pinch around that you need that money for?
Yeah, so this is why times like this when high inflation happen are confusing. High inflation causes mass confusion, in part because things aren't linear. Like what you said makes perfect sense. And this is what happens in low inflation environments, is that eventually the debt gets inflated away. You make your payments, everything goes up, and over time, the debt is worth less. In high interest rate environments or high inflation rate environments, that still happens, but not necessarily the way you think. So let me give you an example. Right now we have, I don't know if you call it high, but in terms of recent history, it's high inflation. We're not accustomed to this. However, if this happens for long enough, it's not going to be the same. So right now we have inflation. Wages are rising as long as inflation's rising. You know, people can't find workers, so they're paying them more. This has been happening the last year or two. So you're getting this inflation, which is great. But at some point, that's going to change into stagflation. And most likely it's going to be next year. We've been talking about stagflation for a while and we've been pushing off because it hasn't been visible. Now it's visible. It's probably going to happen next year because right now times are good, the economy is good, but we go into recession, people stop hiring, they start laying people off. We're already starting to see big companies lay people off, which means that you end up earning less, which means that even though inflation's high, you're not making more. You can't make more money to pay it off. So really you're kind of in the same place, even though the inflation's technically making it worth less, but also at the same point, your real estate is worth less. So the way I kind of describe it, I don't like calling it inflation. I like calling it flation, because some people think, well, it's inflation, but yet we have deflation asset prices, but we have inflation commodity prices. I did a whole talk on this a while ago, which we talk about what inflation is and how it works. And the problem, I'll give you an example for COVID. So COVID, we had a situation where effectively the world shut down. There's effectively no business being done in a lot of the world. Yet, you know, people are still buying things. But inflation, deflation, you'd think, well, this is deflationary because no one's doing anything. And then other people say, well, yeah, but the Fed printed a lot of money. So now it's hyperinflation. There's a lot of inflation. Well, actually, it's both. And here's why. Because people look at inflation and they characterize it in a single way. And actually, inflation is more of an adjective. It is meant to describe something, right? It's not a noun. It's not something on its own. Inflation is a descriptor. So think of it as asset price inflation, wage inflation, commodity price inflation, or in some case, goods and services deflation, or, you know, money supply deflation. Like, it's meant to describe something. So during COVID, we have some examples of inflation. Bicycles, newspapers, cable TV, books, food at home, cleaning products, things like that had price inflation, which was quite high. Some cases like 4 to 6%, even though technically the CPI was low. On the other hand, you had deflation in other products. So here's some examples of deflation: shoes, city transportation, hotels, airfare. I think airfare was down 23%. That was huge deflation.
Not right now, but
Not now. Now it's the opposite. There's huge inflation. It's, I call it highway robbery. I know what it costs to go down to Florida from here. It costs whatever is $100 round trip per person. They wanted to charge me $1,000 per person during spring break. But the point is, it's not uniform. Different things are going to have different price changes. And wages have been more or less stagnant for the last 20 years. People have started to see them go up. But at some point, people aren't going to pay more because they don't need employees. So wages aren't going to continue to do that. That's really the danger, is this is confusing to a lot of people. It's not clear because a lot of the inputs, a lot of the data points that you see are all over the place. I mean, they just talked about college. You're the expert in college. College prices going up like 12% or some crazy number. I don't know how people are paying more, but they're rising them because a lot of their expenses are going up. So this is going to be a very confusing people.
And simultaneously, while the government's taking away even more ways that you can get aid and reduction. So it's definitely going to squeeze the average family in that area. No question.
This whole process is confusing. This is why we're putting out these videos, because we want to educate people on what's actually happening and why. Because if you understand what's happening, you're not going to be confused by some of the things that come out. So when the Fed says, hey, we're going to keep raising rates, it's going to be good, or it's only transient, and you look at it and say, there's no way this is transient. It will become clear, but there are a lot of things that can change between now and then. I mean, I'll give you some examples. I mean, look at, what do they have, rent control? Look how well that worked. It didn't work at all. Or price fixing. None of that stuff ever works. But I can tell you, just because, it's not because I'm a brain surgeon, it's because I've looked at history and it repeats itself over and over. The politicians get squirrely. They decide that people get angry and they just need to make people happy. So they do whatever's expedient. And this is going to happen again. They're going to have price fixing. They're going to have rent control. They're going to do all these things to help people, which is nice. But what if these people never got in that position in the first place? And I think you need to be one of those people that are not in the position where you're relying on the government for them to give you a leg up.
I'm trying to remember exactly when it was. Maybe it was sometime after the Great Recession. You might remember when Pacific Gas and Electric went bankrupt. And it went bankrupt almost overnight because of the control. So the government of California basically said that they could not raise prices of utilities to the residents of California. But they didn't put any controls on the pricing of the producers that was selling the utility power and electric and gas to PGE. So PGE is here in the middle. They can only charge this much. They're getting squeezed in the top. Once that implemented, they were bankrupt within like a couple months. So quickly and effectively, that disaster unfolded.
Think of it this way. You're a questionable company. You have a legitimate business, but you're really pushing yourself. Your cash flows are really questionable. And really, the only reason you're surviving is because you can get cheap debt. That's it. Otherwise, you're in deep trouble. It's great because a lot of these questionable companies that are not bankrupt, because they can easily just refinance their debt at lower rates and keep the payments low, and then they can keep funding themselves and maybe even borrow more. The problem is they borrowed at whatever, 2%, 3%. I mean, high yield bonds were really cheap. You know, you were getting like 2 to 5% on yields.
No risk premium whatsoever on that debt.
None at all, right? So there's no accounting for defaults or anything. That's what the rates were. But now they have to refinance at 10%, 12%. They can't afford it, which means these companies are going to either file for bankruptcy or some sort of reorganization, or they're going to issue equity, which is going to dilute shareholders. Whatever they do is negative for that company. There's no way out. It's like they've got themselves in a quicksand, and the harder they fight, the quicker they're going to go down. There is no way out for this type of situation. This is why we're telling you now. Because a year, 2 years, 3 years from now, you're not going to be able to get out of this. Now you have options. Think about real estate. If I was going to sell my house in the next few years, I would sell now because I have buyers. I can go out there and find a buyer probably within a week. But if you wait a few years, the prices are going to be different. Maybe you don't find the buyers. And I'm not suggesting the world's going to end. I'm just saying this is the trend. And this could happen in a week. This could happen in 5 years. You know, I don't know the future, but I do know the trends. And the trends are just math. And the math doesn't lie. You can't make 1 + 1 = 3. It just doesn't work.
Not unless you're procreating.
Yeah, I've tried.
So I have a neighbor of mine who runs an Edina Realty, St. Paul side of town, up here in Minneapolis. And most of the time, I find people inside an industry tend to be the least realistic about what's going on, right? You know, mortgage brokers, real estate, they think it's going on forever. He said they've been having conversations internally. They've got some realtors that have been there 40 years. Some realtors that started during the Great Recession, realtors that started right before, and then they've got realtors that have started since then, have never been through this. And he said the conversations are crazy. Everybody's looking at the ones that have never been in it before and never been through this. And they have no concept about what's to come. And I asked him, I said, are you seeing anything? He said, they're not seeing any issues yet. Houses are still selling. But he says as early as maybe June or July is when he predicts we're going to start to see a real pull from this, because there's only so long that you can have this raising cost of borrowing and yet prices at that level. And there's a disconnect. The seller thinks they can still get this. But guess what? In the end, guess who determines how much money is available to buy? The banks. And they're only going to give you money based on what your income is now.
A lot of people think that, well, if the banks are in rough shape, then that's why we're going to have a housing crash. The 2008 situation was, I don't want to say unique, but it was a rare event that was mainly caused by the banks. Otherwise, I mean, real estate might have gone down, but it wouldn't have been a crash. It was a crash because the banks basically screwed up and they didn't do their numbers and the risk management right. But this time, the banks are actually in really good shape. They haven't been making bad loans. They're really good with their metrics. And I'm not seeing a banking crisis. I'm seeing a potential housing problem, but not a banking crisis. And I think that needs to be clear, because you're going to hear stuff that say, well, but the banks are sound. The banks have nothing to do with it. It has to do with prices. This gets back to the point. If you're buying and selling in the next few years, then you need to think hard about what your options are. Personally, I'd rather rent for the next 3 to 5 years, and I'll wait and I'll be patient. And at some point, house prices will be within my range. Right now, here's what renting gives me. And yes, rents can go up. So depending on where you are, you need to find something that is reasonable. But the thing with renting is, you know what you're paying. You can potentially lock it in with a contract. You might not want to put CPI as an inflation hedge, but maybe you do, depending on how you want to structure it. Either way, find a property that you can rent for the next few years and wait. And it will give you flexibility, because right now there's so much going on in the world. I would rather have the flexibility. Maybe I want to move to a different part of the state. Maybe I want to move to a different state. If you live in California, you definitely want to move to a different state. Maybe you want to move to a different country, although I don't know where you'd want to move, because everything else is not really necessarily better. But the point being is, I have that choice. If I own a home and prices go down 20%, I can't sell that home, or I just lost a ton of money. It means I have to sit on that home. If the government wants to tax me more to pay for their silly programs that they're probably going to institute, well, now I got a house I can't move and I'm easy to tax. So I don't have flexibility and options. To the point, I'm not saying real estate is a bad investment. What I'm saying is you want optionality during these times. You want to have flexibility to make good short-term decisions. Because if you're locked in with long-term things, and there's nothing wrong if you do, you just need to understand the consequences. If you own a bunch of real estate, if you own 10, 20 properties, great. If you never have to sell them, then you don't need to sell them. It doesn't matter. If you're getting cash flow, get cash flow. Just make sure your debt's paid off so you don't get yourself into trouble.
I think there's one thing that's not being addressed on this. You know, when you're talking about renting, again, going back to people that are regretting their purchases, you talk about renting, you have the flexibility to go wherever you want to go. And I know you said that, you know, no place is better outside than the United States, but of course, all these people living here tell me that everywhere's better than the United States. So I don't know, what do you believe? But when you take a look at ownership, not only can the governments be raising the property taxes, which certainly they're going to have more expenses that they're going to have to fund, because they face, the local municipalities face the same inflation you do. But as people have already seen, since they're not moving, they're renovating their houses, and good luck getting supplies, good luck getting building materials, good luck getting the labor. You may have 10 to 20 places, and you may have your cost fixed on paying to have that place. So you don't have a rising rent necessarily, but between the property taxes and the cost of upkeep, which is a significant concern that people have to factor into their budget that they don't. You know, they typically look at, well, it's an investment. Real estate is a place to sleep. Your home is a place to sleep, not an investment. Ultimately, there could come a breaking point on this asset, which is it's not a depreciating asset, it's a degrading asset. Real estate breaks down. Go look at the videos that you see on places that haven't had occupants in 10 years. They're back. They become the jungle again. So if you're not on top of it, this thing's going to fall down on you, which means the cost to maintain it, who knows what inflation is going to do to that too, which then could be another reason that people who thought they were locked into low interest rates might have to sell. And again, we're going to have an aging population that's going to sell too. The next generation is not going to want to take the home from their parents. They may already have their homes or they want to be somewhere else. Let's look ahead 10 to 15 years. What is going to happen? Is it going to be like we've seen in the past, like similar to the 60s, 70s, 80s? But also, what is going to happen when we start to have an aging population that, again, all of a sudden now there may be a reason that more property becomes available just because the occupants can no longer occupy it?
We did a study a while ago, and what we realized is renting versus owning, we mentioned before, it's a personal expense, not an investment. Most people are conditioned to think it's an investment. It's not. If you actually do the math, it actually is a personal expense. If you're renting, all I have to worry about is paying the utilities and the rent. If you're an owner, you got to worry about fixing the roof, you know, capital expenditures, you have to do the lawn, you have to shovel the driveway, you got to pay all these other things, taxes. If you own, you got to pay all that. And yes, you do get capital appreciation, but you're also tying up a huge amount of money. So I'm not saying it's a bad deal. What I'm saying is if you actually run the numbers over time, you're going to be better off not dumping that cash in because it comes out even. It's not a positive investment. If you kind of run all the numbers, we have a good blog post, which we'll link to this, which discusses this, goes into detail, and actually we give you a calculator, Excel spreadsheet that will do it all for you and show you the numbers that we're using. But getting back to the other point, one thing I want to kind of touch on is I think a lot of people don't understand inflation, and I do want to share something really quickly. So I'm going to share my screen here. So there's this myth that money printing equals inflation. And I want to reiterate this point because everyone is out there talking about the Federal Reserve printed up a ton of money and that's why we have inflation. It's flat out wrong. I'm not saying it's not a contributing factor because it always is to some degree, but I'm going to explain why it's wrong. Now, most people think that money printing equals inflation, which is why we have this inflation. Now, here's the history, the last few hundred years of inflation in the US. Especially early on, there were ups and downs, a lot of ups and downs. You notice right around 1950, all of a sudden we didn't have deflation. By the way, those green down arrows were deflation and the blue ones up are inflation. You notice after the 1950s, we didn't have deflation anymore. Basically, what the Federal Reserve did is they decided we're not going to have deflation because that equals a recession. So we're just going to keep inflation going. Now, all they did is they just kept pumping air into the balloon until at some point it pops. And I don't know when that is. Feels like it's close to now, but I'm sure there's a lot of things they can do to extend that. Point being is this is normal on the left side and the right side is abnormal. And this is where we are. Now, the next one is basically last 100 years or so. So you'll notice that there are good times and bad times. This is just a closer look. So you can see is right around 1955 is the last time we saw it. But the point is there are times, look at the 1980s where it was up to 15%. That was really high. The other times we had wars and other things that were contributing. But we've had low interest rates for a long time. Now we're actually going to be running higher. Now, if you look at this, this is basically debt as a percentage to GDP. This is what a lot of people point to. Oh, look at the right, all of that money that was printed right here. Look at that shoot up. That's scary. That must mean we're going to hit inflation. And it went from 100% to close to 140. You know, so if you look at the next one, oh, look at the money stock, this amount of money out there. Look at that huge shoot up during COVID. Wow, that's going to cause all this inflation. This is what people point to. And I'm only pointing this out for those of you who are not interested in economics. I'll wake you up when this is over. But the point I'm trying to make is these are what people are referencing. And I'm pointing it out because you hear a lot of people talk about it, but nobody actually gives you the math. So this is what they talk about. Wow, look at all this shoot up. And it went from $15.5 trillion up to, I think as of recent, it's close to $20 trillion. That's a huge jump. Now, here's what they don't tell you. This is what we call the velocity of money. And this is where you're definitely going to go to sleep. But if you notice in the late 90s, it peaked out. Now, the simple term, I'm going to use this to come back to describe the economy and how this is going to impact you. This is why I'm explaining it first. The velocity of money is this. If Doug and I have our own island, we have $101 bills, and between us, we exchange the dollar bills for goods and services between each other. That's our economy, to make it simple. And let's say Doug makes shoes and I make corn. So I make corn and I need some new shoes. So I'm going to pay Doug a few dollars. And then when Doug needs to eat, he's going to pay me a few dollars back for the corn. The money goes back and forth. It flows through the economy. Now, if you take this with 350 million people, imagine that expanded through 350 million people. So that dollar goes through society in different ways, and it hits many different people along the way. So people spend money and then they give it to somebody else and they give it to somebody else. The more that money flows around society, the higher this number is. And what that means is that we have a high velocity of money. I'm talking conceptually to keep things simple. And as it's lower, it means people are spending less. Means they're saving more, they're investing more, but they're not spending more. And this is in proportion to the money that's out there. So that's an important point, right? So the more money you create, the harder it is for it all to flow through at the same speed. So this is an important metric. Now, the next one is really where we get in here. This chart is in early 2000 and in 2008, there were a lot of people, and I won't name them because I'm sure you know the names. They came out and said, the dollar is going to go to zero. We're going to have hyperinflation. Everything's going to be worthless. Don't hold your dollars. And they just kept saying, buy our gold, right? That was a big thing. You know, buy our gold because...
Bert, last I looked, isn't the dollar one of the more valuable currencies in the world right now?
It is. Yes. That's a great point, Doug. So if you had listened to those people, you would have probably lost all of your money by now because they were completely wrong for 20 years and they're still saying the same thing. Broken clock is right twice a day. And that's kind of what these people end up being. So the point being is, if you listen to them, you would have thought, wow, this chart should have gone through the roof, but yet it didn't. It just kept climbing in the same way it did. Now, what this chart is something is I created to show what actually happens. So this is the amount of money times the velocity of money. So what you'll notice is during times where there's gray lines, those are the recessions, right? Early 2000s, 2008. What ends up happening is during a recession, all this money or asset value is destroyed. Real estate goes from $100,000 to $50,000. Well, that value is destroyed. So what the Federal Reserve does is they print up money and they fill that hole. So what would happen is it would dip, but instead the Federal Reserve prints money, so it just fills the hole. So it just kind of keeps going. So people who think it's going to skyrocket, what they don't realize is all they're doing is filling the hole. They're not making it skyrocket. They're just trying to smooth the ride. If you notice in 2020, there was a big dip, but then it came back. So think of it this way. They're filling the hole. They're not creating inflation. Now, I bring this back to today. Now, people think that during COVID, we printed a ton of money. You saw in the charts. And now we're seeing all this inflation finally. Well, it does contribute to inflation, as I pointed out, because it fills the hole, right? It keeps us from going into severe deflation. The problem is it's not causing the inflation we have now. The inflation we have now is being caused by supply chain problems. Now, during COVID, everything shut down and our supply chains basically froze because our supply chains are dependent upon a well-oiled machine and you throw a little sand in there and all of a sudden they break because they were too efficient. They weren't resilient. So when this thing happened, all of a sudden prices start to rise because I need more wood to build more houses because people want houses. Okay, but I can't find any workers and I got to pay them more. Well, because I got to pay them more, now that price of wood goes up. Well, now I got to send that wood to the wood mill, the lumber mill, for them to mill it. Well, we can't find anybody either. So we got to pay them more, which means that now the wood prices go up even more and more. And this is how it filters through the economy, is that the supply chain wasn't working properly. So you couldn't find people, which means that the prices kept going up. And as the prices went up, now it's more expensive and the price of everything goes up because it, as we talked about, it filters through the economy. So as the prices go up, everything goes up, and now you have this high inflation. It had nothing to do with the printing of money. It had to do with the supply chain. Now, the supply chain, by all measures from everybody I've spoken to, is probably 3 to 5 years away from being fixed completely. Now, who knows how long it's going to take? I've just heard this from other people, but if you're talking 3 to 5 years, that means inflation's not going away. Yet the Federal Reserve is in there trying to fight inflation, which is, as they've stated, more or less, they're pushing the economy into recession. And the point of that is to reduce demand. So if we go into recession, that means people spend less. If they spend less, there's less pressure on the supply chain, which means prices should equalize and inflation should go down. Based on everything I'm seeing, we got to be in a pretty strong recession or depression to make that work. There's a lot of dynamics that are happening and, you know, everything is up for adjustment. You have to really think of things in short-term thinking, like what I'm laying out is the plan as I see it today. And there are things along the way that will happen that will adjust it. And we will tell you what those things are so you can help plan for it. That's one of the points of this. But as of right now, it's going to take them a while to fix it, which means inflation is going to stick around. Interest rates are going up. Asset prices are going to go down. And we're going to go into recession because that's what the Fed wants. I don't know if it's a mild or a severe recession or depression, but that's what they're talking about. That's why, as we're laying it out, that's how all of this works. So if people talk about the printing of money and all that, you can pretty much ignore them because the Federal Reserve has that, whether you agree or disagree with them managing monetary policy. The fact is that's not a concern for me, and it's not a concern for a lot of others because that's not the issue at hand.
I saw an article today, just to tag on, and I thought it was a really well-constructed article that addressed the same issue. It doesn't matter how much you pump the money up. If it's a healthy economy and you pump the money up, not only will you pump the money up in the hands of the people that are buying, but you'll also pump the money up in the hands of the people that are producing. So when the two things go up in equilibrium, people have more money, but yet all of a sudden, those producers are able to produce more of the things that people want. You don't end up with any inflation, even though nothing gets more expensive because the supply and the demand are in equilibrium. This is 100% the case of the situation where, as you say, we can't get the stuff we want that we're demanding because there's still a tremendous amount of liquidity out there in the hands of the demand side of the buyers, and they're all competing for a limited supply from the producers.
You know, there's a lot of people talk about the wealth inequality that's going on out there. And I totally agree there's wealth inequality. And part of it is because we have low interest rates. If you had higher interest rates, you wouldn't have the same wealth inequality. You can go back decades. We had actually a blog post on this too that goes back decades and shows times where we had high wealth inequality and low or more equilibrium with wealth equilibrium.
And I add on to that for a second because I thought that was interesting because I also brought up in the argument, one of the arguments out there that, well, the wealthy are what's causing this. The super wealth, the 1%, the billionaires are creating this. They've got all the money and that's what's creating this huge demand with limited supply, which couldn't be further from the truth because number one, there's not that many on the broad scale to be able to move the needle and create that disproportionate amount of demand. Secondarily, they are predominantly where they are going to be spending the money that they have. They're not going to eat more because they're wealthy. They might eat slightly more, bigger meals, but they're still eating 2 to 3 square meals a day. They're going to be spending their money on things that are not necessarily going to be major parts of the economy, such as art, fine art, private jets, yachts, and other types of things that really, A, have nothing to do with our inflationary forces that are at bay here and really aren't actually in the same category as what everybody else is feeling day to day in the pinch of their wallet.
If you look back in history, this happens every single time. Remember the French Revolution where they're chopping people's heads off? And yeah, I mean, soak the rich. These are times where wealth inequality is extreme, and it's mainly due to low interest rates. The wealthy understand how the monetary system works and they take advantage of it. They leverage up, they buy as much as they can, they leverage it up, and they make lots of money. That is how business works. And in times like this, the wealth will start to get destroyed. Even then, people are going to be blaming the rich. It's not the rich. The rich are only using the system that exists to their advantage. And they happen to be smart enough to understand how that works. Now, the problem is, getting back to the point, people talk about minimum wage, right? Oh, we got to raise minimum wage because poor people don't have enough money. Minimum wage doesn't solve that problem because all you're doing is you're saying, okay, that's the minimum. So that means everyone else has to charge more, or I can't pay that person because I don't make enough money to pay somebody that much more. So it causes problems in the system. But at the end of the day, as you pointed out, Doug, you have people who are making less and more. So you raise this. And that just means that either you're taking it from somebody else or it's just going to cause them to push up. So the prices go up. If you go from $10 an hour to $15 an hour, well, now instead of spending $100 on food, you know, every week, now you're spending $125 on food. It takes time for this to go through. We talked about earlier and how money goes through the financial system. It takes time to go through the system. But at some point, when it goes through, it starts to rise because people have to pay more. And then other people pay more, and then it just feeds on itself. If you think about it this way, this is actually an important point if you want to understand inflation. Money is created in one of two places. It's either created by the government or it's created through banks. And people don't understand money creation. They think the Federal Reserve creates it all. They're really just part of it. So the government creates money. Who are the first beneficiaries of government money? Well, it's typically welfare recipients, people who need money for one government program or another, the defense industry or contractors, people who get paid first from the government. Those people get paid, or government employees, another example, they get paid first. So let's say today I get my $100 from the government. Now inflation hits. It takes time for my $100 to go through the economy and go to all these different vendors. But by the time it gets to the end of the year, that $100 has had 8% inflation, and now it's worth 8% less. So I actually need $108 to pay for the same good. But I got my money first, so I wasn't affected by inflation. So the primary recipients are the people who get paid first. The ones who get paid down the line, they get hit with inflation more. Now, the other recipient are banks, right? So banks also create money by lending it, and they lend it primarily to businesses, homeowners, people like that. So if you have received money in that way, then you are a beneficiary of inflation because you got it first. And the people who get it after that, those are the ones who are harmed by inflation. So I only mention that because it is a cyclical thing and it will go around and around. It will keep feeding on itself. So let's just say the government kept interest rates at 0%. And they just let nature take its course and, you know, inflation took hold. We have 8% inflation. Next year, it might be 10 or 12 because, hey, I can't sit on my cash because it's going to get devalued. So I got to spend it on something. Well, that causes the velocity of money we talked about earlier that was declining. It causes that to pick up because people are getting rid of their money. And if you do that long enough, that creates hyperinflation. Now, hyperinflation is the worst possible scenario. That is what happened in Weimar Germany. It happened in Zimbabwe most recently, Venezuela. It's happened in a bunch of countries. Basically, what happens is when you allow inflation to take hold and just take off without trying to fight it, it causes hyperinflation. And the mechanism is, like we were talking about, inflation picks up and people realize that. They get rid of their dollars and they buy stuff. They buy food, they buy gold, they buy real estate, they buy whatever they can that's hard, that is a durable good. And they buy that and they get rid of their dollars. So basically, people are getting rid of their dollars just faster and faster. That is the worst possible scenario. So where we are now today, there are two potential outcomes. One potential outcome is that we have hyperinflation. That is, if the Federal Reserve does not fight inflation, they decide to protect the economy and to do whatever they're going to do. That's like one extreme over here. If they don't do anything, inflation feeds on itself, turns to hyperinflation, which effectively, hyperinflation is more dangerous than World War III. That means our country is dissolved. There is no economy because there's no currency to exchange goods and services. We're doing barter. It's a disaster. Look at any country who's been through hyperinflation and you realize it is the worst possible outcome.
And rising interest rates is beneficial because it encourages you to keep some money because now you're going to get paid more for the money that you have.
Yeah, we'll get to that in a second. So basically, hyperinflation is money is worth less and less until it's worthless. Virtually worthless. If you look at Zimbabwe, they're carrying wheelbarrows full of Zim dollars, as they're called, to pick up a loaf of bread.
You mentioned the Weimar Republic. I mean, in the 1920s or 30s, Germans were burning marks just to stay warm.
Yeah. Wallpaper, toilet paper, burning it to stay warm. That's what it becomes. It becomes worthless. So that's the worst outcome. And the government knows it. Everybody knows it. So I don't see that happening. And the other extreme is the government decides, you know what? We're going to fight inflation. No matter what happens, we're going to fight it. Paul Volcker was famous for this. He fought inflation and protected our economy, even though it put us into a deep recession and people didn't get reelected because of it. But he did the right thing. Now, whether we have that kind of leadership now, I'll leave that up for your discretion. I'm not sure I'm convinced. But if they decide to fight inflation, that means we go into a recession or a depression, depending on how severe they have to fight it. So if they keep pushing up rates, that's where we're headed. And that should protect the economy, but it's going to be painful in the short term. And you should expect that pain. And you should expect that if we go into a bear market, nobody wins in a bear market. And this is a really key that I mentioned last time. In bull markets, everybody wins as long as you're playing the game, right? Everything goes up. Bonds go up, stocks go up, real estate goes up, everything goes up. Everyone's a winner, right? It's like the casino. Hey, everyone's a winner. But in a bear market, it's not like that. It's the reverse we talked about earlier. It's the inverse of that, which means in a way, everybody's a loser. The people who do the best in a bear market are people who lose the least. Now, notice I didn't say make money. You don't try to make money in a bear market. The job is to lose the lease. The reason I say this is you might think, well, why don't I just put all my money in cash? Yeah, you could do that. And you would lose to inflation. But at the same point, let's just say right now, if I had my money in cash, I'd lose 8%. So my $100 would be worth $92. But here's the key piece I want to talk through, because I think it's hard to conceptualize, but I'm going to try to do it here. Take cash. Cash doesn't make money. It doesn't lose money. It's worth the same. Inflation causes it to lose 8%. I have stocks. Stocks right now, depending on what you're in, are down somewhere between 15 and 30%. Also lost 8% on top of that due to inflation. Bonds, 30-year treasuries are down somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 to 25%. Safe bonds. Everyone hear about those safe treasuries? Yeah, they're not really safe. And let me actually share this visual with you because I think it's really important. Gary Schilling put this out many years ago. I'm going to simplify it. The top columns are the amount of time, 30-year bonds, 25-year bonds, 20, 10, 5-year bonds. That's the time. And in the vertical column is the yield from 1 to 15. Now, if you'll notice that if rates change 1%, this is what's going to happen. So if rates go from 14 to 13, then you're going to make 7 to 7.5%. However, if rates go from 1% to 2%, it means you're losing about 24%, which is pretty close because that's approximately what 30-year treasuries are down. So if you look at that, that means that at lower interest rates, the returns are more dangerous. People think bonds are safe. They're not safe. They are an asset class which has been a benefactor of the last 40 years of lowering rates. But as rates go up, it means your bonds are not safe. It means they're going to lose value. And if you say, well, I'll just hold it to maturity. Yeah, if you want to hold a 30-year bond paying 1% for 30 years, good luck to you. Because at some point, rates are going to be up at 15% and you're only making 1%.
Well, and Kirk, most people don't hold bonds. They hold bond mutual funds, bond ETFs, and those are affected very differently because they're traded and now you have valuation change. People have to understand the difference when they think, well, I've got bonds. There's a difference between holding bonds and a bond investment.
Absolutely. If you're holding an actual bond, you have that luxury. If you're holding a fund or an ETF, or you have some manager doing it, then you probably don't have that luxury. You would basically be losing value. And either way, your account is going to decline. And that is very unsettling for people who are conservative. So I only mention it because most people don't understand how bonds work. They're generally simple vehicles, but people have got accustomed to bonds being safe. I mean, our whole industry talks about bonds being safe. Diversify into safe bonds. They're not safe. They can be safe. That's what I call an investment half-truth, because they can be safe. Last 40 years, yes, they were safe because rates were going down. But as rates go up, they're actually dangerous. If anything, they're risky. Because if you have a 1% bond that is going from 1% to 2%, you're not making enough to account for the loss. So it's really dangerous, especially for people in retirement.
Most people don't even understand what bonds are. I mean, if you were to look and say bond, and then actually look at what kinds of bonds of fixed income, is a laundry list of different kinds out there, and they all act differently. It is much more complex than trying to decide between stocks, large stock, small stock, much more similar than maybe two types of bonds may be. They could be completely different.
Yeah, there are many, many types of bonds. And even in treasuries, there are many different types of treasuries. For instance, a lot of people don't know this. I think we talked about this last time, like the best performing asset class in the last 40 years was 30-year zero coupon bonds. People don't even know that what a zero coupon bond is, but effectively it's a riskier type of bond. But you could have made a lot of money. But now if you're in those, it's going to be the reverse. So remember we talked about earlier that a lot of what we've experienced, you're going to start to see the inverse of that. So a lot of these assumptions you've made, buy and hold, diversification, all these assumptions you think are correct are not necessarily going to be correct. And you need to be aware of that, that this is why the paradigm is shifting. I want to get back to a point I was making before. We're talking about minimum wage and how that's affecting things. This effectively next year is going to lead to stagflation. Now, inflation, right, is when the cost of goods and services go up, right? You could have wage inflation, goods and services inflation, all that. But stagflation is one of those weird things that we saw in the 70s. And oddly enough, we have another circumstance. We're eerily going to be going into a same situation probably next year. Right now, we have inflation in a lot of areas because we have wages going up. You know, it costs more, so you got to pay people more. So you have this rising of tide. So wages are going up. But next year, most likely, the wages are going to be stagnant, where prices are going to keep going up, which means that people are going to get a harder and harder time to pay for goods and services. That's what we call stagflation, where we have quote unquote inflation in goods and services, but yet we have wages that are stagnant or the economy that's stagnant. I mean, economy going to recession is not stagnant, but that's what the term is meant to describe, is a stagnant economy, which means that inflation is going to price people out of goods and services. Now, we talked about this last time, that my gas prices have close to doubled. My food prices have doubled in a short period of time. You know, I can pay more, but a lot of people in this country can't. So where do you get that money from? From other parts of your household expenses that you can't spend. So you don't buy that extra pair of shoes. You don't go out to eat as much. You don't travel as much. This is all going to start to happen and start to filter through the economy. And that's one of the biggest problems with inflation.
Something came out the other day that it was showing that consumer credit cards as the starting point of that, those that have gone into 60-day defaults is the largest spike, I believe, in at least a decade, if not longer. That pinch is already starting to be felt and no one's talking about it.
Yeah, it's a great point, because that leads into what happens next. If you're not prepared for this, if you don't have cash, I'll make this point because a lot of people are going to tell you the exact opposite because they have for the last 40 years, is that cash is actually safe to some degree. You need to have cash. You need to have savings. Because if you don't have savings, when the bill goes up and you don't have that cash to cover, you're in trouble. You need to have extra savings. And what's going to start to happen is most of this country, I think 70% of it, don't have any savings, which means that as these prices go up, they don't earn more. It means that they start borrowing more until they're tapped out. And credit card companies are well aware of this, and they're not going to extend more credit to people if they don't have to. So people are going to get tapped out and then they're done. Then they start defaulting on debt. So you're going to have a huge amount of defaults, especially in the credit industry, credit cards and what have you, a lot of defaults. And rates are going to go even higher once you default, which means you can't get out of that cycle. So you need to pay down the debt. So that default is going to start to happen with individuals. It's going to turn to real estate. It's going to turn to a lot of companies as companies refinance their debt. So basically what happens is this starts the recession and it starts the snowball rolling. It gets bigger and bigger as rates go higher. This is actually, believe it or not, you know, I showed you that chart earlier of inflation, deflation over the last few hundred years. That was normal. Normal was, hey, we go into the cycle. Now we go into recession. People go bankrupt. It stinks. It's tough. It's part of life. Some people win, some people lose. But once we get through that cycle, it cleans out the bad decisions. If you decide to start a business, you know, selling, I don't know, buggy whips, and there's no more horse and buggies, it's a bad business. And you probably deserve to go bankrupt. And sorry if you own that kind of business, but...
But what if the buggy is too big to fail?
Well, that's a whole nother problem. But basically, those businesses deserve to fail, and they will. And what will happen is some investor will come in and say, I'll buy that for 10 cents on the dollar, and they'll make a good choice, and they'll actually make a profit on that business. This is a normal economic cycle. This is what happens, has happened for thousands of years, and will happen for another thousand years. And what's happened in the last 50 years, they said, yeah, I don't think we should have a recession. I think everybody should be winners, right? Everyone's a winner. But then no one's a winner, because at some point in time, you have this big problem, which I would estimate we're starting to see now. So what that means is a lot more bankruptcies, a lot more foreclosures, a lot more defaults. And if you're patient, that means that you could probably find good deals at some point in time in the next 5 years, because people are going to be struggling. They're going to need help. And I'm not saying that you should take advantage of people, but if you don't help them out, then what choice do you have? If they want to sell their house at a discount, what if they can't sell it? They owe money and they go into foreclosure. Well, what happens? The bank takes it over and then they sell it to an investor. So regardless of what happens, it eventually ends up in the hands of investors, whether it's through foreclosure, through the bankruptcy system. Our system is actually a well-designed system to handle this kind of problem. So I think you just need to understand that that's a risk in your own life, but it's also an opportunity. If you're prepared, you have cash saved so that you can actually go buy the things you want to buy when, you know, the asset prices bottom out.
One last thing, and then we'll kind of bring this thing to the finish line. Warren Buffett, he's been sitting on a treasure trove of cash the last couple of years during this hot supposed market. People have constantly asked him, why are you not investing? Because you're not making enough. He always says, you know, if I don't have cash, I don't have any options tomorrow. And he's always said, buy when people are selling, sell when people are buying. Again, there's got to be a little contrarian thinking to what the masses are doing versus what you should be doing, but you got to put yourself in position to afford that. Now, coming to the end, let's talk about this for a second, just to kind of summarize this up. What should people be doing right now? Let's talk about a couple of things they should be thinking about, and then we'll just leave the juicier details next time. But one thing I do want to take away from what I'm hearing from you, there's no tinfoil hat, there's no conspiracies. This is just economics.
Yeah, this is economics 101. I don't like peddling fear. A lot of people do it because it sells newsletters, it sells newspapers, and people get people whipped up. People come to us all the time whipped up in fear, and I hate it because it causes people to make bad decisions. When you're afraid, your executive function, your thinking, your rational thinking just disappears. You're operating in your primal brain.
It's a survival mechanism for a time before we ever dealt with the economy. This is living back in the jungle, just trying to find your next meal. It helped you to live. But now it can work against you.
Right. And you should understand that. And that's why I hate when people peddle fear. But unfortunately, there's a lot of that out there and there's probably reasons to be. So we're going to talk about some practical takeaways you can take away from this conversation. And we're going to have many more conversations about different topics because there's so much we have to tell you that you should stick around. And every week we're going to put out new episodes just to help you prepare. So the first thing you can do is to start saving cash. Save cash. You know, we call it emergency fund. Save an emergency fund. Everyone's different. It might be 3 months, 6 months, 12 months. You know, that's up for talk with you and your financial advisor. But generally speaking, save up an emergency fund so you have extra cash. And don't worry about it losing value. The point of the cash is not to make money. The point of the cash is to protect yourself. The second thing you should do is pay down debt. First, pay down variable debt. Variable debt has to go. And don't start adding more. Probably should put this as step one, is pay down debt. But I think it's psychologically important to save cash because that gives you ammunition. It gives you options. You can pay down debt or not. It's totally up to you. So that's why I like putting cash first. But pay down debt, variable debt first, especially consumer debt. Do not spend extra money that you don't have on things that you don't need or are consumables. If you're buying a house, great. That's different. That's an asset that's going to retain its value. But anything else that's consumable, don't overspend. Spend what you have. And third, work on a budget. Figure out where you can save money. We're all spending way more than we need to spend. I don't remember this too well, but I remember a little bit. I remember the times, like the 70s, early 80s, people didn't have much, but they still survived. Everything was fine. They didn't need five TVs. You know, they were fine with one if they had any. You know, we can all get by with less than we have.
Mean I should keep the latest iPhone more than 12 months?
You might want to, yeah. Assuming you want to keep an iPhone. I mean, I don't know.
I'm a Samsung guy. But anyway, yeah. Point is, you know, we see people flipping these phones, the latest, greatest, newest thing. Maybe that's not the best decision right now.
Yeah. And if you have lots of money, that's great. This is going to affect you too. Don't think you're immune to this just because you have more money. It's going to affect you in different ways, right? You're still going to lose. If you have all cash, that's one thing. If you have assets, they're going to decline. So everyone needs to make themselves more resilient. So create that budget, you know, look through it and just see what you can eliminate. Maybe you're really tight anyway and nothing you can eliminate, but I'll bet everybody can eliminate something that they don't need or don't use. After that, then start looking at deleveraging other areas. This is not an emergency. If you have a 2% mortgage, it's fine, but just make sure that you have your income and your expenses are wide enough apart. And this is like rule number one, spend less than you earn. I know it's simple, but people don't do this.
Let me write that one down. That
I'm going to say it again just for you, Doug, so you can write it down. Spend less than you earn. It's simple, but people don't do it. Oh, I need that car. I need those shoes. Oh, well, I need that today. Spend less than you earn.
Something can be simple, but still be hard. This is one of the most difficult concepts in a society that is constantly doing everything they can to get into that primitive brain and make you part with your money.
And you need to follow this. You need to spend less than you earn, because if you don't, you're going to get yourself into trouble. And then there's not going to be really any way out of it. With low interest rates, you can always find a way. With high interest rates, you can't. You're going to get steamrolled because it just starts adding up and adding up. And then there's nothing you can do. So definitely spend less than you earn. I think those are some good enough tips for today. We can come back with some more next time. But I think it's just basic home economics. Just be responsible with your money. You know, if you're not earning enough, if you're already in a hole and you're not earning enough, get a second job, get a side gig. there's a ton of people out there who have made this a whole industry of side gigs, and there's plenty of ways to earn extra money, but now's the time to be more resilient. Make your family, make your financial life more resilient. And you'll thank me for this 3 years from now when other people who didn't are really struggling and you're in good shape.
I love the connection with home economics because it also means that as things get tighter, maybe learning to cook is a good thing. Got to keep those expenses down. So go back to your old home economics and home ec. Those things may be good. Polish up on a little bit. Thank you very much for the time on this Friday, Kirk. It's been a nice pleasure speaking with you today. And I look forward to our next one. We'll get into this a little bit deeper. And of course, if anybody has any questions, needs to talk to someone about how they're feeling, obviously, Kirk's going to give you some information on how to reach out and have that conversation, as well as you could have a conversation with me. But appreciate the time today. Thank you, Kirk.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Doug. Appreciate you helping me out here. And we're going to have you back on to interview me again. And we're going to keep talking about this, because until we have educated as many people as we can on this, we're just going to keep at it, because this is a message that needs to get out there and soon. And I will just tell you from my experience that from living through a few recessions before the early 2000s, 2008, is when people start to lose money, they stop making good decisions. They start getting fearful. They stop making intelligent decisions and they just wait. And sometimes doing nothing, that is a choice. Doing nothing is a choice that you can make, but sometimes it's the wrong choice because it just means that you're not making an active choice. Either way, if you don't make a decision, that's still a decision.
I think the key here is to tell the truth about money, and that's what we're doing and how it's going to work. And ultimately, if we can change the mindset of just one person and help one person to be in a situation where they're going to be prepared for the things that can come, what we call the certainty of uncertainty, then this has changed, transformed a life and maybe even a generation, because that kind of learning goes on and on.
We'll keep publishing these as well as our inflation survival guide, which we'll give everybody access to once we finish it up. I just tell you that you can find us on moneytreepodcast.com. You can also find these videos on innovativewealth.com on our blog. Certainly you can find us on YouTube. Thanks again for joining us, and we will come at you again next week.
Thanks again, Kirk. Have a great day.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.